Welcome to Unburied Books, a podcast reading through the NYRB classics. I'm Kasia.
And I'm Dylan. Our book this week is Life and Fate by Vasily Grossman. It was first published in 1980.
Interweaving a transfixing account of the Battle of Stalingrad with the story of a single middle-class family, the Shaposhnikovs, scattered by fortune from Germany to Siberia, Vasily Grossman fashions a detailed tapestry depicting a time of almost unimaginable horror and even stranger hope. Life and Fate juxtaposes bedrooms and sniper's nests, scientific laboratories and the gulag, taking us deep into the hearts and minds of characters ranging from a boy on his way to the gas chambers to Hitler and Stalin themselves. And to discuss this book, we are joined by poet and translator of Life and Fate, as well as many other works by Grossman, Robert Chandler. Welcome, Mr. Chandler. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you.
I'm wondering what first brought you to Vasily Grossman. What drew you to his writing? Did you know at the time that you would end up playing such a big role in his legacy and his work in your life?
I really had little idea of all of those things that you've asked me. I probably hadn't heard of Grossman, and an older Russian friend of mine, an art historian, a Russian Jew, Igor Golomshtok, who is quite an eminent art historian, but he was working at the time at the BBC Russian service, which was a really wonderful place for several decades during the Cold War. A lot of really most intelligent Russian dissidents were working there. And we'd made friends some time before, and he just brought me this enormous book and said, if you want to establish yourself as a translator, you should translate this. And I just laughed and said, I don't read books as long as that in Russian, let alone translate them. Igor is a very obstinate man, and he did four half-hour programs for the BBC Russian service, which were sort of half extracts and half his summaries of passages from the novel. And he sent me those. This was a little bit more manageable, sort of 30 pages instead of 900.
Yeah. I see.
And I'm sort of, in a way, impressed with myself that even though I didn't, at the time, I was more interested in poetry, I was more interested in more modernist fiction. Work like Grossman seemed rather old-fashioned. But I did, thank God, have the sensitivity to notice that, you know, there was something special about this. And so I did take up the challenge. I didn't actually translate it for NYRB. I translated it for what was then Collins Harville in the UK. And I translated it, and it didn't really attract much attention for 20 or 25 years. And then it was partly the NYRB republication, partly it was especially the interest of a number of important historians, you know, Anthony Beaver's book about Stalingrad that was very successful. He quotes a huge amount of Grossman. Anthony Beaver was constantly mentioning Life and Fate as one of the great war novels of all time. So it was really from the early 2000s that the book began to get noticed.
We also like to talk about the cover art on each one of our episodes. And for this one, it seems like an archival still of Red Army soldiers in Stalingrad. I was curious if they talked to you at all about the idea of this for this cover. And I was also wondering, do you think, I understand the like visceral, honest, here's a picture of Stalingrad. Do you think there's an artistic picture that could be representative for the book, if for a different cover, maybe?
I do quite often. I am quite often involved in choosing covers for the NYRB books. In some occasions, I have just straightforwardly accepted my choice. In the case of both Life and Fate and Stalingrad, they weren't my suggestions. I didn't play any role in them. I was perfectly happy with them, but I didn't question them. There is a wonderful tiny book called A Stalingrad Diary. I mean, in Russian, Stalingradsky Dnevnik, published in 1948, which I would love to see republished in Russian or English or both, which would be perfect illustrations to Grossman. I think we included one or two of his drawings in Stalingrad. It was by a the writer's name, the artist's name. He became quite a well-known official and rather dull Soviet artist, but in 1942 he was with the frontline troops of the of the advancing Russian Soviet forces that eventually encircled the Germans. He was with them and doing drawings absolutely on the spot, which are just utterly straightforward. They're not grandiose, they're not heroic, they're really great. And he also did portraits of a number of Russian soldiers, of some of the important generals. They're all just absolutely straightforward. They're not Soviet heroic at all. And it's ironic given how, the fantastic and ever-increasing emphasis that Putin's regime have been putting on the Stalingrad victory, and how much this is always being trumpeted. And the one really great set of drawings that came out of that battle are practically unknown. I'll have to send you the Finogenov, Konstantin Finogenov is the name of the author, of the artist. And I think at least two of his drawings are in the NYRB edition of Stalingrad.
Mm.
Splendid. Thank you for telling us more about that. I wanted to just discuss briefly the two books that lead up, in a sense, to Life and Fate. I mean, War and Peace is always evoked in conversation with these two books. Grossman said it was the only book he read during the war. How do you see this duo, Stalingrad and Life and Fate, as maybe progressing the Russian war epic after Tolstoy? Tolstoy also puts forward this idea of the fate of the nation being determined by the people and not by the great men. Do you think Grossman shares Tolstoy's view?
I can't answer that with very much confidence. He certainly, Grossman certainly did think that there was a genuine turn in the popular mood in the Soviet Union in late 1942, that a defeatist attitude on the part of the ordinary soldier did somehow metamorphose in Stalingrad into a genuine patriotism. He doesn't take sort of Beaver's line that the Soviet soldiers were just fighting because they didn't fight the Germans, they'd get shot by their own commissars. That is not Grossman's view. Grossman doesn't, he to some degree goes out of his way in a lot of his Stalingrad writing. He mentions Stalin less than was required by the authorities. Even during his Red Star articles at the time, there are surprisingly few mentions of Stalingrad. So he's certainly not seeing Stalin as the great man who determined the Second World War. He does give a lot of credit to some of the individual generals. Mm-hmm. So a kind of mixed answer to your question, I think.
That's true. Continuing the line from the previous book, Stalingrad, as we talk about throughout probably most of this episode, it's a lot of the comparison and contrasting between the two is about this somewhat Stalinist, Stalingrad mentality, and then this much more de-Stalinized, anti-Stalinist Life and Fate. I'm just curious if there are any other similarities or differences that you see between the two, and if there is one that was more difficult to translate.
It's hard to say about the difficulty of translating because there's such a huge time difference. Mm-hmm. Life and Fate, I was pretty much on my own. And with Stalingrad, I had access to any number of different helpful people who could fill me in on factual details through emails and email forums. So that made that task a lot easier. The difference between the two books, some people clearly prefer one book to the other, but it's probably 50-50. The difference is that Stalingrad is it's more immediate. It includes more of Grossman's, some almost verbatim passages from his wartime notebooks. You know, lots of brilliant little vignettes of real life conversations between soldiers and so on. Life and Fate is written later. It's valued more by people who, most of all, are interested in sort of politics and philosophy. Whereas I think actually that Stalingrad as a novel is more vivid, and I don't in the least see it as a Stalinist. I mean, especially with all the passages that were restored, or the many witty, ironical passages that were deleted by his editors at the time. So I think actually for its time, you know, given the severity of the Stalinist censorship, Stalingrad was just about as outspoken as Life and Fate was for its time.
Speaking about the sort of censorship, there are a few times in this book you denote missing sections with text brackets and like a very long ellipses. What do these mean, and why did you choose of representing it this way?
Sometime in the next few years, I hope to revise the translation of Life and Fate. I translated, it won't need a lot of revision, but I translated it from the Russian text that was published in 1980 in Lausanne. That was put together very painstakingly from two different defective microfilms. The editors did a very, very good job, but there were a few missing passages there. And there is now the Grossman's final text is now available. I mean, I have it on my computer. It's in the main Russian literary archive. So that is a better text than has yet been published, even in Russia. There aren't big differences. It's not a big deal, but, you know, there are small things here and there.
That's really exciting. I'm wondering how you got a handle on Grossman's language. Was he a different sort of writer to grasp than the other Russian authors that you have worked on?
Russians often assume he would be fairly straightforward to translate because he's not a modernist. He doesn't go in for, you know, he doesn't create words. He doesn't go in for unusual stylistic effects. But there is a real difficulty, which is a massive amount of factual detail in his work. So, you know, there is stuff I needed to find out about sort of, you know, the system of ration cards during the war, this kind of thing. But also his sentences are so loaded with detail and sort of translating them, you know, lots of embedded participles and so on. So the having been recently promoted general wearing the something cap walked up to the sitting in an armchair. You know, they've got all these little details in a single sentence, which, you know, you cannot possibly preserve the structure. And so, you know, the usual solution is to split the sentences up, but then you discover that you've somehow managed inadvertently to sort of make the least important thing seem as if it's the most important thing. So there's a lot of rewriting, you know, a lot of redrafting to get those kind of things right. And sometimes, I notice this particularly in Stalingrad, I mean, I think he's rather unkind to the reader. There is a chapter in Moscow where Victor Strum is, it's a meeting of probably about 9 or 10 men, all of them eminent minister, you know, senior people's commissars in charge of industry and munitions and so on, and top generals and so on, and Strum, mining, you know, bosses of important mines. And there are about 10 of these men, most of whom we haven't actually encountered in the book before. And Russian has a tendency to dislike repetition more strongly than we do. So even, you know, most Russian writers will quite often alternate between, say, referring to Mostovskoy as Mostovskoy, or, you know, a few sentences later, they'll call him by his first name and patronymic, Mikhail Sidorovich. So you get that kind of alternation is quite normal. But Grossman does it to an extraordinary degree. So, you know, one moment it'll be, the mining engineer from the Urals, and a paragraph later it would be the bespectacled engineer. And I had to sort of, you know, do a great table of these 10 different men and the different ways in which Grossman referred to them. And it really was quite a lot of sort of tedious work just getting that clear, because there's just no way. I mean, the English reader's going to find it difficult enough distinguishing between the 10 men, even if you refer to them consistently and by the same name. So,
yeah.
That kind of thing, just sort of basic tact with the reader.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm wondering if this idea of repetition, or trying to not repeat names, sort of goes along with the individuality of this person. And this is something he stresses on the first page of this 900-page book, likening the people of Russia to the uniqueness of briar roses. I was curious what you thought of the importance of starting this, you know, epic with this single idea.
Well, I was rereading the first pages of the book just now, and he does, yes, I mean, he's emphasizing the first two chapters, he's emphasizing two central themes, the individuality and the need for freedom, which probably goes with that. I would quite like to read a passage from the beginning of the second chapter, which I think it...
Please do, we would love that.
I think it very nicely conveys the sort of delicacy of Grossman's irony. It's quite funny. And I was also struck, just reading it a couple of hours ago, I mean, I've read quite a lot of literature to do with the German and Russian camps, and I was sort of struck by how fresh Grossman's account still seems. I'll read a page. And it's kind of funnier than is perhaps immediately apparent, because the early Bolsheviks, like Mostovskoy, you know, they were very emphatically internationalists. That was, you know, Stalin's big change, was to move from internationalism and world revolution to the idea of socialism in one country. So, beginning of chapter 2. In the German camp, for the first time since the second Congress of the Comintern, Mikhail Sidorovich Mostovskoy had the chance to make use of his knowledge of foreign languages. Before the war in Leningrad, there had been few opportunities to speak to foreigners. Now he remembered his years of exile in London and Switzerland, years when he and his fellow revolutionaries had talked, quarrelled and sung in nearly all the languages of Europe. So that's the sort of romanticism of the early Bolshevism, which Grossman has some sympathy towards. Gardi, the Italian priest who was Mostovskoy's neighbour on the bedboards, had said that there were 56 different nationalities in the camp. The tens of thousands of prisoners shared the same fate, the same pallor, the same clothes, the same shuffling gait, and the same soup made from Swedes mixed with the ersatz sago, known by the Russians as fish eyes. The camp authorities distinguished the prisoners by number and by the colour of the stripe sewn onto their jackets. Red for politicals, black for saboteurs, green for thieves and murderers. People unable to understand one another in the confusion of tongues were bound by a shared fate. Specialists in molecular physics or ancient manuscripts lay on the bedboards beside Italian peasants and Croat shepherds who were unable to sign their names. A man who used to order breakfast from his cook worrying his housekeeper with his bad appetite, walked to work beside a man who had lived all his life on a diet of salt cod. Their wooden soles made the same clatter on the ground, and they looked round with the same anxiety to see if the Kostrega were coming round with their rations. The very differences in the lives of these prisoners gave rise to a certain similarity. Whether their vision of the past was a small garden beside a dusty Italian road, the sullen boom of the North Sea, or an orange paper lantern in a house for senior personnel on the outskirts of Bobruisk, all these prisoners, without exception, had enjoyed a wonderful past. The more difficult a man's life had been before the camp, the more furiously he lied. This lie had no practical purpose. It served simply to glorify freedom. How could a man be unhappy outside the camp? So kind of there are a great many of Grossman's central themes kind of gently introduced in those first chapters.
That was beautifully read. Thank you so much for that. I think one of the really interesting things structurally about this book is the way Grossman uses pairs of characters and also scenarios in order to kind of play off one another. So in the first half we have, we were following two political prisoners, Mostovskoy in a German and Abarchuk in a Russian prison camp. How do you kind of see those two situations relating to one another? Why do they remain so devoted to the revolutionary cause despite this kind of harshness and sameness of treatment that is also emphasized?
Why do the Russians remain so devoted to their cause?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I suppose that's really answered most fully in the Kromov chapters at the end when he's in the Lubyanka. And I remember, because this was one of the things I remember Igor first talking to me about, was that, Arthur Koestler perhaps isn't as highly rated now as he used to be, partly because of his personal history and accusations of rape that have been levelled against him and so on. But Darkness at Noon was one of the first great anti-totalitarian novels, and people used to talk of the Rubashov complex. Rubashov, I think, being modelled on Bukharin, and Bukharin, who was the sort of nearest thing to a moderate who remained in the Stalin's inner circle till the early 30s. Bukharin was so, even when he was being tortured, he was still unable to sort of part with his devotion to Stalin and the cause. And this is what Arthur Koestler addresses in Darkness at Noon. Why did these people confess? Just given the argument, saying that it was torture, doesn't seem quite enough, and it wasn't enough for Koestler, and it's not enough for Grossman. It was just that's what Grossman is trying to bring out through those Kromov chapters at the end, that it was just too unbearable to sort of give up one's belief in everything that one had stood for such an important, such a huge chunk of one's life. And I remember Igor saying that sort of, in future people, I don't think this has actually happened, but people should be talking about the Kromov complex rather than the Rubashov complex.
We'll start that here.
Yeah, absolutely. On the other flip side of Kromov and these people is Viktor Shtrum, a nuclear scientist that Grossman sort of describes his work of splitting the atom as upsetting sort of the traditional understandings of nature and stability. That kind of goes with the idea that there's this enforced reality and there is something here that is sort of pulling these two things apart. How does this character reflect Grossman's view on scientific progress, the nature of reality, and the implications for modern Soviet warfare?
As a young man, Grossman certainly was passionately interested in physics. He probably attended lectures in Kiev by a a physicist whose surname was Strum, who was executed in the 30s. Grossman remained interested, obviously, in physics throughout his life, and his notebooks include diagrams of the splitting of the atom. It's one of the aspects of Grossman's thinking which I haven't often seen addressed, is when he talks about probability and the way that in quantum physics you can't make definite predictions about a particular particle. You can only say that there's such a probability that such these particles will behave in a particular way. He draws a parallel between that and both Hitler and Stalin not being bothered about individual guilt or individual responsibility, that they were more concerned with simply the fact that among a particular class, whether it was the peasantry or the intellectuals or whatever, there was a higher probability that opposition to him might arise from that class. So, let's not worry about establishing individual guilt. Let's just do away with that class because there's a higher probability of them being oppositionist. So he stresses that quite a lot throughout the book. There's quite a lot of chapters about where also in the chapters about the death camp, David and Sonia going to the gas chambers, again, they're sort of eventually people cease to be individuals as they're getting close to their death, and they're just like kind of molecules flowing around. So that's perhaps one of the things which I haven't seen picked up very often in discussions of the book.
Since you bring up the passage of Sophia Leventon and David on the train going to the concentration camp, I mean, there's so many harrowing portions of the book. We also are given access to the perspective of different Nazi characters, like the accountant who has to tally the bodies of the dead, or the person who's monitoring the gas chamber to ensure that everyone has died before he opens up the doors. How, as a translator, do you approach kind of rendering the emotional impact of those scenes? Do you approach them differently than you approach other parts of the book?
Probably not in this case, but I can tell a relevant story with regard to another work by Grossman. I think perhaps one of Grossman's masterpieces is the chapter about the terror famine in Everything Flows, and that is told from the perspective of a woman who, a minor party official who played a minor part in implementing it, and it is excruciatingly painful. And I was working, Life and Fate I translated on my own. Everything Flows, I was reading everything aloud to my wife and discussing it sentence by sentence. And my wife has multiple sclerosis and she's quite emotionally vulnerable. So I was wary of inflicting something so extremely painful on her. And I was questioning her, do you want me to read this chapter? And she would say, let's give it a start. And we'd do a couple of pages and she seemed okay, and I would say, well, the next passage will be worse still. Do you want to do it, carry on the next day? And somewhat to my surprise, she did want to carry on right through the chapter. And the way I understand it is that there's never any sense of Grossman wanting to hurt the reader. Some writers, including some very great writers, it's as if they have, they are suffering from some deep internal pain, and it's as if they sort of think that if they hurt the reader by expressing this pain, they will sort of escape from this pain. And Grossman just isn't doing that. There's a story that he believes needs to be told, and it's his responsibility to tell it. He didn't, you know, he didn't go out of his way to go to Treblinka. That's where, you know, that's where his fate took him. And in any case, you know, because of his mother having been executed, he couldn't possibly escape from those themes. So there is a kind of sense of which, well, I think of, I mean, Grossman did write a lot about several very hellish things, but I do see him as a equivalent to a Virgil in Dante's Inferno, that, you know, he is a wise guide who is you know, showing you what needs to be shown, but is not wanting to inflict unnecessary pain on you. So of course the passages, actually I can add one thing that, I mean, I do remember feeling, of course it was deeply, deeply painful to translate those chapters from Everything Flows, but it wasn't interfering with my sleep, for instance. There's, you know, some other work that disturbs me. It does, you know, there's something so sort of, so supremely sane about Grossman's writing that I can cope with those passages.
It's impressive how he's able to sort of slowly build these tensions in a very linear way with this sort of, not repetitious, but like you said, it's very plain, honest writing as it goes. And it's able to overflow on a really emotional scale. A lot of these thematic ideas are expressed, and again, we're talking about pairs of characters. Probably the biggest pair is Krimov and Victor, as far as someone who is very staunchly in the camp of Stalin with Krimov, and then with Victor, someone who actively voices against the state itself. I'm curious, what do you think are maybe their characterizations or personal experiences that influence each of these people to go a certain way and then lead them to their ultimate conclusion, which I think both would find a little surprising about where they end up towards the end of the book, given their ideals.
They're both, I mean, Victor Strum is the more obvious self-portrayal by Grossman. But it is interesting that Grossman gives a great many of his own real experiences during the war to Krimov. And that's perhaps a little bit more noticeable in the earlier novel, but Krimov's, in Stalingrad, Krimov visits the Tolstoy estate, and that is, you know, practically verbatim from Grossman's own account in his notebooks. So there's a lot of Grossman's own experiences, especially during the first year of the war, he gives to Krimov. And, I mean, Grossman does, he does have quite a lot of sympathy with the early revolutionaries. So he can sort of, I'm sure he is successful, well, I mean, he does successfully imagine himself into Krimov's role.
You said earlier that you thought that Stalingrad was maybe the more vivid of the two novels. I was wondering if you had any thoughts as to why that is. What was it about that work that didn't end up in Life and Fate?
There's just so many little details in Stalingrad, of all these kind of tiny snatches of conversation that Grossman noted down in his wartime notebooks, and he's able to introduce them very easily. And there's probably a greater number of characters in Stalingrad. Life and Fate, he is, you know, he has set himself a different task. He is both making a political point, but also, you know, he's addressing more overtly addressing a very serious moral concern of, you know, how free are we to, you know, do we have the freedom to make, can we make moral choices when we're faced with really appalling situations? And, you know, that's much more overt in Life and Fate, and that's what makes a lot of people value it, and it's one of the reasons why it's become more valued now than it was when the English translation was first published, because in the sort of 1980s, moral philosophy barely existed. It wasn't sort of considered as a serious discipline by Western philosophers. Whereas, now, I mean, the Jewish philosopher Emmanuel Levinas, who wrote in French, he's a passionate admirer of Grossman. Grossman is the only writer, I think, who he repeatedly refers to in his philosophical texts. And that's one. I mean, people are coming to Grossman for a variety of different reasons now. You know, some people are reading him because of his account of the Second World War, others because of his account of the Shoah, because of this new interest in moral philosophy. So he just has set himself different goals in Life and Fate.
Yeah. As far as Victor goes, he, in thinking about this idea of sort of conscience writing, he gets a call from Stalin towards the end of the book, basically rehabilitating him and supporting him, even though Strum has been speaking out against Stalin this whole time. And looks like he's going to be arrested. It's looking quite dire for him. And I think it's interesting that Grossman immediately pairs that with a call from his maybe unconsummated emotional lover, Masha, who tells him that, you know, she's admitted to her husband that she's in love with him. Also later is like, confronts him and almost sort of prays for him about how after the Stalin call, Strum signs a letter possibly damning people to their death, at the very least to the prison's camp. How do you see these two calls pair with each other? And what is the counter to each other? Because both are quite... I've been struggling for the word about these calls, but they're somewhere between thrilling and heartbreaking. They're very interesting. What do you think about those two?
I haven't thought enough about that particular pairing. I kind of thought more about the Stalin call than about Masha's call. I mean, it's pretty straight autobiography. Grossman did in a weak and depressed moment sign I suppose in late 1952 he signed a letter he shouldn't have signed with regard to the new Stalin's new anti-Jewish pogrom that was just getting underway. And Grossman's, the woman he loved, the prototype for Masha in Life and Fate, Zabalotskaya, certainly represents his conscience. You know, she was always deeply understanding. And these telephone calls from Stalin were, there were quite a number of instances of individual writers or scientists receiving telephone calls. Pasternak, most famously being asked his opinion of Mandelstam. They were very, very real and life-changing events, and people agonized about them and discussed them for endlessly. There's any number of pages written by different people like Nadezhda Mandelstam about how well or badly Pasternak behaved when asked about Mandelstam. There were a few physicists who were absolutely uncompromising with regard to, they just did not try to placate Stalin at all. And the physicists were probably the only people who Stalin recognized as being so important that he couldn't just do away with them if they misbehaved.
I'm wondering, you talk about the book so much in concert with Grossman's autobiography. When you were first handed that monstrous book, you said you weren't that familiar with Grossman. I mean, learning the fiction and then learning the truth of his life, did those two processes happen simultaneously, or did you have to start with fiction and then learn maybe where some of this inspiration came from later?
I suppose they've both been gradually evolving. I mean, when I was first, the first book about Grossman was the biography by John and Carol Garrard. I forget when I first read it, but it was certainly, must have been after translating Life and Fate. There's a memoir by Liebkin, which is beautifully written, Grossman's friend, but Liebkin does, he very kind of deftly wants to paint a picture of Grossman that would be as appealing as possible to sort of to a Western audience. So he does sometimes make Grossman out to be sort of more of a more overtly anti-Stalinist and more hated by Stalin than was actually the case. And these pictures are gradually being kind of the realities, gradually replacing the myths. And I'm particularly grateful to one of my closest collaborators on our recent books, Yulia Valokhova in Moscow, who has been doing wonderful work both in the main literary archive in Moscow, but also in the family archive, which was in a very chaotic state. And she and another colleague are bringing out being published around today. I mean, it's a first large, very well conscientiously edited collection of Grossman's letters in Russian. So that's what, you know, they've been working on for several years. And it clearly corrects a number of myths. So, you know, I've quite a few times unwittingly repeated some of these myths myself. So one particular myth is not an especially important one, but that because Stalin had it in for Grossman, which was, you know, very much Liebkin's belief, because of this, he chose to remove Grossman from Stalingrad just before the final victory, so that Grossman wouldn't have the honour of kind of reporting on the final victory. Well, you know, it's quite clear from Grossman's letters that that just isn't true, that Grossman actually had to stay in Moscow because he was working on a script for a film about Stalingrad. And so there's, you know, little factual details which are gradually being corrected over time. But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, patient, tedious work goes into making those corrections. And Grossman isn't a beloved figure in today's Russia. There are very few scholars in today's Russia doing this kind of basic work of establishing reliable texts of his work. And we're still a long way away from that. I mean, there's a lot of Grossman's stories from the 1930s and 40s, you know, they still have not been published in uncensored texts.
Yeah, absolutely. We talk a lot about Viktor and Krimov in this book, and that's because, as you're talking about, they bring an autobiographical lens from Grossman. It's probably the characters that carry the most narrative and thematic weight to the book. But these two people are connected by being married into this family, the Shaposhnikov family. I'm curious what you think of the female characters in this book and maybe what they add to it, Ludmila, Zhenya, even Vera or something.
I was thinking, actually, I'd love to know more about the artist, Evgenia. I don't think I've ever really read any discussion of whether she is based on any particular figure or purely someone Grossman dreamed up. She's a very appealing figure. Ludmila, well, obviously based on Grossman's wife. Like Tolstoy's wife, Grossman's wife often gets rather a bad press. Both of them, you know, did these rather awful tasks of having to type out their husband's work, even when their husband's work was, you know, clearly not very enjoyable to them. So, you know, Grossman's wife was having to type out these chapters about Victor Shrum's love affair with Marcia and so on, which, you know, she appears to have done quite uncomplainingly. Both wives are often seen as kind of rather sort of hard and philistine and not adequately understanding of their husband's genius, but they certainly had a lot to put up with, and we've got a lot to be grateful to them for. And the girl, Nadia, I mean, I love She's just so wonderful. It's funny and lively. The Grossman's daughter. I mean, I love all of that. Very, very memorable.
Yeah, I could read a third 900-page book just about the daughters of the family. But there is a line from the book which kind of emphasizes this kind of the mother or the wife is like kind of the heart and as the sufferer of a lot of the pain and violence that's going on in this period. Everyone feels guilty before a mother who has lost their son in a war. Throughout human history, men have tried in vain to justify themselves. And this gets at some of the one of the big kind of theoretical preoccupations of Life and Fate, just war theory and you know, whether or not Russia's engagement with the German forces, even how awful the Nazis were, you know, can it really be justifiable? Can this victory at Stalingrad be a triumph given the cost? What do you think about Grossman's treatment of those political, philosophical ideas? How did you approach them as a translator?
I don't think his philosophical passages in Life and Fate were particularly difficult to translate. But I would like to say that what we've been working on most recently, which will be published this summer, is a collection of Grossman's articles that he wrote for Red Star. And I am deeply impressed by the kind of wisdom he shows in the last articles in this book. So, you know, written in from Berlin in May 1945. There are several accounts, perhaps just one account, but it seems that Grossman was actually quite depressed at this time of victory. It's anyone's guess as to which were the most important reasons, you know, possible reasons are that, you know, his dismay at the number of rapes being and other violence being conducted by Soviet troops, that's one possibility. Another possibility is that with the war over, it sort of allowed him to reflect more on the horror of the Shoah and all the, you know, his death of his mother and all the enormity of the Shoah. And he chose not to attend the Nuremberg tribunal. He absolutely, and he is reported to have said sort of, what is with regard to the destruction of Berlin, you know, what's there to rejoice about the destruction of such a beautiful city? And what impresses me most of all is that he notices in several places in Germany, it's part of their blackout precautions. The Germans have a phrase which I'm not going to try to repeat in German, but the meaning is light means death. So, you know, if you don't observe the blackout precautions, you may get bombed. It's a perfectly sensible, you know, logical thing to do. But he moves from that to seeing it as a kind of expression of the Hitlerite regime, that they equate light with death. And, you know, and then he ends that article by quoting Goethe. Goethe on his deathbed is supposed to have said, mehr Licht, more light. So he's kind of contrasting the Hitler's equation of light and death and Goethe's call for more light. And he is wonderfully, you know, ending this article by quoting from a German writer, which, you know, in these days, in today's world, where, you know, so many Ukrainian sympathizers want to damn writers simply for being Russian, no matter how opposed they are to Putin's war, you know, Grossman's breadth of sympathy and his quoting a German writer is it is wonderful.
Excellent point.
Yeah. To close out, we wanted to just briefly talk about the final chapter of Life and Fate. It's quite a shocking and strange one. It is devoid of all character names. We seem to be apart from the characters that accompany the last two major volumes in this epic. What do you think is your reading of that? Do you think they relate to any specific character? I was reading that it might be linked to a character from Stalingrad, but I was curious with what was your view of choosing that?
Yeah, I think it probably is Byrotskin finally reunited with his wife. But obviously, Grossman's gone out of his way to sort of, at least partially, anonymize him. So perhaps just to make the point that this is, you know, countless other people might be having similar experiences. I think it is a very beautiful chapter. And it's actually quite a long time since I've looked at it. I mean, I wonder whether perhaps it might be a paragraph or two to read right now.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, because Grossman, I mean, he's not seen as a poetic writer, but I do actually, I often draw a contrast between him and his close friend and equally great writer, Andrei Platonov, that, you know, Grossman began as a journalist and his writing gets increasingly poetic towards the end of his life, most obviously in his last short stories, whereas Platonov began writing poetry and extremely difficult prose and wrote more and more simply as the years went by. Grossman quite clearly, even at this stage, was quite capable of writing very poetically if he wanted to. So, the chapter, at least the paragraph about light. So this anonymous man and his wife walking along the shore of the lake. The snow here hadn't thawed. Its large rough crystals were filled with the blue of the lake water. But on the sunny side of the hill, the snow was just beginning to melt. The ditch beside the path was full of gurgling water. The glitter of the snow, the water, and the ice on the puddles was quite blinding. There was so much light, it was so intense, that they seemed almost to have to force their way through it. It disturbed them and got in their way. When they stepped on the thin film of ice over the puddles, it seemed to be light that was crunching under their feet, breaking up into thin, splinter-like rays. And it was light that was flowing down the ditch beside the path. Where the path was blocked by stones, the light swelled up, foaming and gurgling. The spring sun seemed to be closer to the earth than ever. The air was cool and warm at the same time. See, I don't think many people would, if you just read that out of context, I don't think many people would guess it was by Grossman. It's just a nice indication of how many different kinds of, you know, styles and areas of content that he is able to address. I remember also I sent one of his last stories, which is called The Dog, and it's about one of the first dogs to be, it's a fictionalized version of the first Soviet dog to be sent up into space and brought back down to Earth. And the friend I showed it to, who didn't know much about Grossman, her response was that it was really shamanic. And, that was just, I was so fixed on the idea of sort of Grossman as being such a sort of sane, sensible writer that it was quite startling to hear him described as shamanic. But, you know, she was absolutely right. And there is a kind of mystical quality to and that story and, you know, to that hymn to light that I've just read. So thank you for reminding me of that.
Yeah.
No, well, thank you for drawing our attention to the poetic and shamanic qualities of Grossman's work.
He has as much uniqueness and individuality in his writing that he gives to the Russian people and humanity as a whole in that way.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we go? This has been a great discussion.
Maybe a point that he makes in he makes most clearly in the Armenian sketchbook. He's shocked that no one in the Armenian capital of Yerevan, none of the writers he meets, seem to know anything about Mandelstam, who had famously written a journey to Armenia and written a very fine poem cycle about Armenia. So he writes a few paragraphs about Mandelstam, whom he clearly has mixed feelings about. That he does, he can see, Grossman can see the beauty of Mandelstam's work, but Grossman isn't a modernist, and he's somewhat critical of modernism and refers to Mandelstam as being like a jeweler as opposed to a baker. So, you know, Grossman's, and actually Platonov's ideal really, is that, you know, a writer should be supplying people with their daily bread. And Grossman's criticism of a lot of modernist poets is that they're creating very beautiful jewellery, which is all very well in its way, but it's not what is most essential. And that's something which I've been thinking about over the years. And I suppose I, perhaps initially I was sort of a bit shocked by Grossman's seeming critical of modernism, but I suppose as the years go by, I have more and more sympathy with it. But anyway, it's an interesting point. Okay, I think that's all I want to say myself. So thank you very much. It's been very enjoyable to talk to you both.
I want to hold up our copy of the book. You can just see how many tabs we have marked here. So clearly, yes, hours of enjoyment were had thanks to your work.
Something a little bit similar, but that's actually Stalingrad, which I've been talking about more recently. But yes.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, we finally did it. We read Life and Fate.
I know. It's one we have planned on for a long time since we did Stalingrad. It was finally interesting to see how everything came together in the end of all the different characters and where they went. And I liked how Chandler talked a little bit about how, you know, Stalingrad's maybe a little bit more expansive and diverse. When I was reading it, I kind of thought of Stalingrad as a rock with contours and texture. And this is more of like a serum, like very direct and synthesized. Just two very different like textures and emotions that came out of the books themselves. I don't know, does that sound weird? You kind of give me a look.
Rocks and serums.
Rocks and serums, yeah. One of the things that we didn't talk about with Chandler, but I thought I wanted to bring up, because we talked about this one specific part with Beaver, was the not one step back.
Right.
Because in Stalingrad, Krimov hears that order and goes, yes.
Yeah.
We're holding the line.
Uh-huh.
And in this one, two characters talk about how that is representative of bureaucratic horror and how people are able to pass laws and initiate systems that cause violence and death. And that seems to be a very differentiating point between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it comes down to this great line that Victor Strum says. Victor says this line, I think this sums up his storyline and Krimov's storyline well as one. What power, the state and the individual. The state raises a man up, then throws him effortlessly into the abyss. And I think it raises up Victor and casts Krimov into the abyss.
Oh, I see. Yes. As a recovering international relations major, it's hard for me to talk about the state.
That's true.
I've spent so much time talking about the state.
Do you think you see the state similarly to Grossman in the way he discusses and portrays it over this book? Is this sort of what was taught to you in school? Okay.
Definitely no. I like depends on which school.
Sure. Depends on which state you were probably taught as well in school.
Oh, absolutely. But that this book is also a representation of that, of literature as being really nationalized.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the most interesting things about it is that you don't just read the book, you read editions of the book and translations of the book and the archives and the journalism, and then it all becomes this like bigger thing.
Yeah, I really want to read the later Grossmans now, the final works.
Well, I think Chandler wants us to read them too.
Yeah, he does. Hopefully we can have him back on for that, because I'm sure they will further these discussion points that we are.
We're lucky we got 5 minutes of his time.
It's unbelievable.
Well, thank you for spending at least 5 minutes with us. Listeners, thank you for tuning in. Our theme music is composed by John Hoekstra.
Join us again in a month's time when we discuss another classic.